Hear ye, hear ye, word nerds. Be forewarned that this podcast contains saucy language of the modern and early modern varieties, so plan your listening accordingly. Or don't. That's a choice that you can make, but don't say we didn't warn you.
And then also, low-key, I'm like, I'm gonna have to learn GarageBand. I'm gonna have to learn it. I don't understand why I can't just figure it out. Like, but every time I've sat down to try, I
YouTube
don't.
Tutorials are incredibly helpful with that.
Girl, you're right.
Also, I'm happy to just sit down with you and teach you the basics anytime you want.
Word.
So.
I mean, probably we should do that. Because, like, what if you lose both your hands in a freak teaching accident?
Yeah.
What if your middle schoolers tie you up and chop your hands off in a paper cutter?
Oh, God. Welcome to the Hurly Burly Shakespeare Show. We are your hosts,
Jess Hamlet
and Aubrey Whitlock.
And together we are Hamlet. And this week we're talking about Keith Hamilton Cobb's American Moor.
Yes, we are. Whoop, whoop.
We're doing a new thing. This is our first 202 level episode. What the fuck does that mean, Aubrey? If it means anything,
because so
text is a lie, nothing is real.
Yeah, so that means it's kind of a hybrid of a 101 and a 201, because it means we assume that you have a passing familiarity with the source text of whatever adaptation it is we're going to talk about, or whatever adjacent play we're focusing on. So we don't need to summarize that play, in this case, it's Othello, right? We don't need to talk to you more about Othello. But you might not know today's play at all. So we will be blending some of the features of a 101 and the 201. So you'll get a lot of the introductory stuff that we usually give you in a 101 so that you can engage a little more deeply with today's play and kind of know what you're going into if you're about to see it or read it. But you'll also get some of the close reading and like topical stuff that we do in a 201, particularly about the overlap between this play and the Shakespeare play that it speaks to. So there's that. That's essentially what it is, and we're going to try it out and see how it goes.
Yeah. It's going to be what it's going to be.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah. But first, let's have a happy hour.
Yeah.
Let's have an hour that is happy.
Just one?
Just a single one.
Okay. Great. Cool. Well, in our happy hour, we tell you about stuff that we like that's, you know, diversity focused and inclusive and all those good things, but also like just good things that make you cry with joy. And with me, for me this week, that is this little 10-year-old British girl named Nandi Bushell. She's a drummer. She has like her own YouTube channel. Maybe she's on Instagram too. But she, she's been around for a while. Like I discovered her the first time, heard about this kid, like, I don't know, 6 months ago in 2020. Because she had a drum battle with Dave Grohl of Foo Fighters.
Oh, your boyfriend, Dave Grohl?
Yeah. Yeah. Dave Grohl.
Oh my God.
I love him
keep
so
it in
much.
Your pants, Aubrey.
Sorry, I'll keep my shirt on. He makes me want to tug on my shirt a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I fucking love him. But she, so like, she put herself kind of on his radar by, playing, she records, what she does is she records herself playing the drums to a number of, you know, hit songs. And she did that for Everlong, which is one of Foo Fighters' like most famous songs. And she, at the end of that, was like, Dave Grohl, she's a little British girl, I challenge you. And like, he kind of ignored it for a while. And then finally decided to respond. So they have this adorable video together where he is doing his Dave Grohl thing, like mean mugging at her the whole time. And she's, you know, playing the drums. But what's so great about her, and I've watched some of her other videos too, where she's not on the same screen as Dave Grohl. But she, like, she is so joyful when she's playing the drums. And when she's like, I'm not a musician, so I don't know what all these techniques are, what it's called, but like when she's really just jamming, she like screams with joy and you can see it on her face and she looks at the camera and she's like, "Wah!" And she's just effervescent with joy at her drumming. And I like, I don't know. Maybe I was in like a weepy place, but also I don't know what to do in the face of that much happiness, and it makes me cry. So I'm like sitting watching this little girl who is so happy at her drum set, just pounding the drums, and she's so, so joyous. And I just don't know what to do except sob at that. I'm just like, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. And I love this little girl so much. Never grow up, little girl. Never grow up. Yeah, it's the best. I'm like crying even thinking about it. It's the fucking best. She's so, like, if you ever need a pick-me-up from anything, just Google this kid and watch her YouTube videos is all I'm saying. Because you can't not smile when you watch her. Cool. You just can't. Can't do it.
Okay.
But particularly the video with Dave Grohl is like the best. Okay, but I'm done.
Sure. Because he's your boyfriend and you love him.
I love him.
He makes you squishy.
He does.
We could not be more different. And like, I know this about us. I know that we are not the same. But when it comes to our taste in The Gentlemen, I'm
a big sucker for a rock star with just long hair and a sneaky sense of humor.
Does nothing for me.
Oh, man.
Okay. Well, so the first thing I want to acknowledge today for our happy hour, for my piece of happy hour, is that today is February the 14th, and it is therefore the greatest day of the whole year. It is Oregon Statehood Day. Today is the anniversary of the day that Oregon joined the Union. And Oregon is the best state, and that's, I'm just, shout out to my truest love is the great state of Oregon.
Happy State Day, Oregon.
Yeah, it's my sweet little Oregon. It's all grown up now and like a real state. It's, you know, full of Republicans and white supremacists. It's not the liberal haven you all think it is, world.
No, it's not.
But it's not bad. It's not bad. It's beautiful and wonderful in other ways. Also this week I signed up for Nudge Text, which you can follow them on Instagram at Nudge Text, which is a lifestyle planner friend all via text.
Hmm.
They do like a lot of different programs, but it's Black History Month. And so what they're doing this month is how to be a better ally. And this is being run by a woman named Dr. Akila Cadet, which is spelled like cadet. And you can follow her on Instagram at Change Cadet, but Cadet, because that's how say her name. And so on Sunday or maybe Monday and Thursday, I got an 8 a.m. text and a 6 p.m. text with just like, let's learn a little bit. And then like, here's an action item to be a better, it's really cool. It's really, really cool. And so this week we learned about vocabulary, allyship, microaggressions, and diversity in the workplace. One of the things that the 8 a.m. Thursday text was a Daily Show segment on diversity in the workplace and how there often is none of that.
Uh-huh.
So like, it, you know, I thought of you because I know that you love the Daily Show.
I do.
I know you do.
Trevor Noah and his little dimples. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's, I encourage you all to check it out. See if that's either of those things is something that you would like to do. I knew a lot already of what we were taught this week, which I think is a good sign. But I also appreciate the chance to learn and think more and be reminded of some stuff, and then have these like action items, right? Of like, here's something that you can do based on, you know, whatever your situation is. So like the Thursday night action item was, you know, are you employed? Are you self-employed? Are you a student? Are you not employed at all? Respond to whatever category fits you best. Mm-hmm. And then we're gonna email you, or we're gonna text you a script that you can use to email or to post on social media at the company that you work for, or where you go to school, or a brand you like that says like, hey, I notice that you, like everybody else in the world, made a statement about diversity and Black Lives Matter back in June. How you doing? Mm-hmm. What have you been doing to uphold those values and ideas?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been really cool. So I encourage you to check it all out.
That's
everybody.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I'm learning some shit.
And that's our happy hour.
Yeah.
Clinkies.
We're happy about it.
We are. That's cool. Okay. So in keeping with the hybrid nature of a 202 episode, we're foregoing the 5-word unhelpful title, because that's irreverent for this text.
No,
because we don't need to do that. So we're skipping to the dramatis personae. Mm-hmm. In this play, in American Moor, there's only two of them. There's the actor
The director, I guess, who has like 6 lines.
He's not as you know. It's essentially a one man show with a little bit of support from a voice of a director elsewhere, not on stage with him.
Yeah. Right?
Because that's kind of the point. You only see the actor. So why is this play so goddamn popular right now?
Ooh, honey child.
Right? On our script, just so the listeners know, it just says because in all caps. So
I mean, it's you know, this play has been gaining traction pretty steadily over the last 3-4 years. 2-3 years? When did you see it, Aubrey, for the first time?
I saw it in 2019, and it had been in workshops and been around already at least since 2018.
Yeah, I guess it says it was showcased in New York in April 2015, so that was the first time.
Okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
But really, it's really, really come into its own in, you know, 18, 19, 20, not 20, because 20 is a pandemic year. We write that off. No one got anything out of 2020, but he's had a couple like really kind of big, exciting, important tours of the show. He had, you know, he's done it off Broadway. He's done it at the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse in London, which is attached to the Globe. He's gone all over the place, and has also been having in this year of pandemic where he can't like actually do his show, has been kind of doing like a speaking tour almost. There've been like a lot of Zoom events with like a conversation with Keith Hamilton Cobb. He's doing a thing at SAA this year, the Shakespeare Association of America annual meeting in April. He's made like an archival recording of the performance available for educational purposes, so I've gotten to see it. It's getting taught in my department soon, very soon, if I haven't already missed it, but I think still coming up. So a lot of my program cohort are going to be able to see it pretty soon. It's having a moment, because it's this perfect storm of calling out white American theater, but also in this moment of like a national watershed reckoning with systemic racism and police brutality in this Black Lives Matter moment that has been going on for a long ass time, but really, you know, hit a flashpoint this summer. It's getting more important than it was. Yeah. I mean, it's still important, right? Like I'm not trying to say that this wasn't important before this year, because it has been and is. This is perhaps the most riveting and transformative piece of theater that I've ever experienced in any form. It's real fucking good. So it's you gotta get your hands on it in some kind of way. You need to buy the script and read it, or follow Keith Hamilton Cobb on Twitter and figure out where you can see him talking about it next.
There are a couple of short little clips if you find like that you can find on YouTube, some excerpts, both of him like specifically looking at the camera, like features he has made, but also
yeah,
some performance recordings. Oh, you know.
Also it's like all up on his website. P.S. AmericanMore.com.
Yes.
There's an entire videos tab where you can watch snippets of performance and yeah, him doing like interviews and shit, video audio reviews.
Yeah.
It's all kinds of, so AmericanMore.com. AmericanMore.com. Let's say that like 18 more times.
AmericanMore.com.
Yeah, AmericanMore.
We will definitely link to it as well in the show notes on this episode landing page. So don't worry. I mean, I think you're right. It is the subjects that he speaks on in this play have been a problem, right? And have been something that Black actors playing Othello, particularly in America, have faced for way longer than 2015 when he sort of piloted this project. But I think the social context right now, right, is amplifying the message of this play more so than it had been before. So yeah, it's having a big moment right now, which is great, because I do think everybody needs to see, read, hear the words of this play in some way and think about it. Then like, I want this always to be in rep with any production of Othello going forward. Please let it always be in rep with Othello going forward.
Yeah.
Please.
I mean, this text appears in my standard cover letter that I've sent out to every job that I've applied for this cycle, every single one. It's a featured thing. I'm like, here is something that I care passionately about. Here's the kind of course I would like to design, for this job, for your school. American Moore, man, because it hits all of the things that I care about in my pedagogy and my work. So
yeah.
It's real important.
It is. And we, Jess and I went back and forth a lot with like how, you know, in a 101 play, we usually summarize in some way. We summarize the play for you. So I think what we're going to do, because we're not going to, it doesn't take 5 minutes to summarize a one-man show.
No.
But also, we want to let this play speak for itself, or let the author of this play, because he is still living and doing his thing, speak for itself. So we went to AmericanMore.com.
Yes.
And this is the synopsis that it gives. So this is our summary for this week.
So first thing, not first thing, but right there on the homepage, the American Moore website, it says, a play written and performed by Keith Hamilton Cobb, examining the experience and perspective of Black men in America through the metaphor of William Shakespeare's character, Othello. And that's what it is.
Great. I want to give you, because it's not terribly long, but it is a modern play with actual stage directions at the top of the play to set the scene. So I'm just going to read that. And
great.
So this is how the play is situated. This is how it's set up. It's mise en scène, if you will. I sound so pretentious every time I say that, but I'm going to just say it anyway. So here are the opening stage directions. As the audience enters, the Black actor is sitting, standing, or leaning against something somewhere on an, quote, empty stage. It is empty in that it is unfinished and unfull, yet it is strewn with the detritus more or less common to most theater spaces between productions. Somewhere downright, facing three quarters in, is a single chair. Somewhere else, the actor is amongst all of it and actively waiting. He, quote, prepares, moves, stands, stretches, sits again, perhaps recites or mumbles, but mostly he waits. Always he waits. From time to time, he checks his watch, the way one might if perhaps an appointment had been scheduled for noon and it is now 12:20. He looks to be about middle age. He holds a worn paperback text of Shakespeare's Othello. The title of the play should be clearly legible from a considerable distance. That's for our prop designers in particular. Most often throughout the play, he will treat it with reverence. He is a tall man, powerfully built and handsome, and only imposing if you see him that way. His black button front short sleeve shirt with sleeves rolled up over his biceps is tailored to fit his torso like an officer's dress shirt and is tucked in at the waist of khaki chino pants, cinched by a plain black leather belt, all giving the appearance of a casual but somewhat militaristic uniform. But on his feet, he sports a pair of black high-top sneakers. As house lights dim, he can be heard articulating a section of Othello's speech to the Senate, somewhat under his breath, perhaps, but audible, referring to the text now and again. Intermittently, but perpetually, he massages and stretches his right shoulder, and he waits. And then it launches into the actor, and he's saying some lines, mm-hmm. practicing for his audition, etc.
When I read this text over the summer with my book club, shout out to my book club, which, just for all our listeners out there, we read Twilight and then we read American Lore. that's what we did. To be clear, all of us had read Twilight before, but we were having our Twilight Renaissance of summer. Anyway, it's neither here nor there. One of the things that we talked a lot about was the use of stage directions in this play, mm-hmm. because they are very prescriptive, yes. and very lengthy, yes. in many, many places. At least one of my fellow book club members has a degree in theater, so comes from a theater background, is no longer a theater maker like myself. And the other one, I think, sees a lot of theater, but I'm not sure that she ever has done theater. Mm-hmm. Also, my book club is just three people, so like, whatever, it's fine. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they were both like really struck by these stage directions in ways that I wasn't. And the reason that I wasn't, I think, is because I didn't read them like stage directions in the traditional sense. To me, I picked mm-hmm. up this text and I went, oh, this is a movement score for like a piece of devised theater. Mm. Because that's what this show is, right? This is a project mm-hmm. that he wrote, that he devised out of many, many workshopping runs. Mm-hmm. And so this is a physical score.
Mm.
Right. It's, as far as I know, the play is not yet licensed for performance for other people. Right. He's right. still the only one who's ever done this.
Yeah. I mean, it's getting there now that it's published. I think that's like the next step is for.
Right.
You more could solicit the rights to perform this now.
But, you know, in the interim, this is a personal record mm-hmm. of a personal document of a personal performance for one person. Right. It's a score. It's not a direction.
Yeah. Well, and I'd say that's pretty typical for one person show.
Sure.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because there's usually no other scene partner or a sporadic scene partner, like in this case, right. you know, because he does have some time to play off of the director at some points. But yeah, mostly mm-hmm. it's, you know, his the actions and the way you write about the actions in a solo show are as important as the words you say. Right. Exactly. And especially if you were to license this play for other performers, you would mm-hmm. want to maintain the integrity of that experience for the audience. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and I mean, this mm-hmm. is a feature too. Like if you're strictly an early modernist, like you and me, there aren't a ton of really lengthy prescriptive stage directions in early modern plays, you know, unless it's like a dumb show. And even then they're weirdly a dumb not show or specific. A mask. Like sometimes, like there are something, you know, they just had different priorities, right, in writing those plays. But like living playwrights care very much about the integrity mm-hmm. of their work and the way they want their work to be understood. And so, these stage directions don't surprise me at all in their length and prescriptiveness. But there's a lot of them. And I think reading, you certainly can't gloss over them, right? But they are mostly notes for the actor and like what's going on, his internal monologue. And some of it is his movement, but a lot of it is like, you know, he backs up, turns around, wanders a bit, ostensibly preparing to deliver the monologue again. Then with any false bravado and servility he can muster, he walks forward, stops at attention with the stomp of his foot, and he bows before the Senate. Right.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
I'm here on page 24, mm-hmm. Where he's having an exchange with the sort of disembodied director, who says, "And one more thing, could you, I have this thing about the soft R's. It always sounds to me like someone attempting to sound British. Could you try and stay aware of that?" And then the stage direction, such as it is, says, "And what do you say when the very awareness and intellect that define your humanity are answered with inanity?" Like, that's a score, right? That's not, how do you direct that?
That's on page 24 for you?
And yes.
I'm not seeing
any of
that.
Do we have the same edition?
I think so. But I'm looking at page 24 and I'm not seeing that on the stage direction.
Textual instability.
Seriously, though.
I mean, are you even...
What I'm looking at on page 24, it starts at the very top of the page, "Othello, question mark, you gonna enlighten me? Fuck you, white boy." That's the first line on page 24.
What?
Yeah. Wait, what?
Okay, all right. Let's collate our editions. You have an introduction, yes?
Uh-huh.
From Kim Hall.
Yeah.
Okay, that does not have page numbers, or does
Correct.
Have page
does
numbers?
Does not have page okay. numbers.
Great. And then we have the title page, more with the epigraph from Thing.
And then a note regarding stage directions. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's helpful.
Okay, and then, so the first page number that I have is page 4. That's the first one that's printed.
The first that I have is page 6. It's a blank page where the stage directions start, and then it jumps to 6.
Okay, so I'm 2 pages ahead of you. So check page 26.
Okay.
Let's see.
Yes. Okay, there it is.
Okay. All right.
That's so weird.
That's bonkers.
Wow. That's
textual instability.
Yeah, man. In the same printing. See, this shit still happens, people. Mm-hmm. It still fucking happens.
That's wild.
Wow.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I hope if any of our listeners out there have a copy of the text that they all went and looked to see what page number that was on for them.
Since we're talking about stage directions, I do want to go back now and read his Great, little half page note regarding stage directions. Let's see with what Keith Hamilton Cobb has to say about that. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a play that requires the sole character on stage to address several different amorphous entities, some that are not physically present, and an audience, another amorphous entity that very much is. Some instruction regarding when to address whom will be obvious in the text. Other of it is explicitly stated in the stage directions. But much must remain the discovery of the actor and director from production to production, influenced by stage and seating configurations, lighting, and other non-static factors from one production to the next. In this discovery, the audience should find and will find itself playing many parts. It is not intended that this process leave them in comfort. But throughout, the actor must return to them, often with love and an open heart. He must return to engage them as travelers on this road with him, because that is what, in designing to sit and experience this play, they have agreed to be. Most of them. He has a big dramatic ... most of them. The actor asks early on that they trust him, perhaps not with words, but by confiding in them. If his tale is to be heard and, more important, believed, he must take responsibility for their trust. This does not mean that he should mitigate any of his well-earned emotional expression, for what would he be without it? His audience will most clearly see his regard and responsibility for them in the ways that he returns to them. Mm-hmm. Which I found so true sitting in the audience for this show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there were times, I mean, I know, you know, from our training in grad school, we were sort of taught to look at the audience, address the audience, you know, talk to them. And it's become a habit, you know, for me to like really try hard as an audience member to catch the eye contact that's given to me, right? Mm-hmm. And be there for it and be present for it. And that's fine when it's a fluffy early modern play. It is something else entirely when Keith Hamilton Cobb turns to you at like the height, you know, like an emotional climax moment, with like tears and rage in his eyes, and holds you there. And that happened at least once for me. And I'm it was, but that's what made the play such a wonderful experience for me. Wonderful and also terrible, right? Like, how can you be in the face of that? And believe me, I was not sitting there being like, oh, yay. But it was like, it was gripping. So yeah, I completely get what he's saying with that. I'm glad he articulated that, though, for the actors that come later and maybe do this play themselves.
Yeah, it's very important. Yeah, I mean, for me, and I want to acknowledge that we are two white girls talking about a play written by a black man for a black man performer about the experience of being black in America and in the Shakespeare industry. So this story is not ours, and it's not really for us, except that in the way that it is for us to do the work of making America and the theater industry and the Shakespeare industry
witnessing
more inclusive
and believing.
Place. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he says
it's
here.
It's for us in that way. Yeah. But this is, you know, this is a play about racism. This is a play about microaggressions. This is a play about white men thinking that they know best what it is to be black, what it is to be a fellow, what it is to be a Shakespearean or an actor or whatever, but that it's their story to tell and it's their job to fill out the vision.
Absolutely.
And also, P.S. that's not okay. It is not the job of white people to dictate how to be black and how to be Othello and how to be a Shakespearean. Like, we should not be gatekeeping in this way, and we should work to disrupt that gatekeeping when we see it happening.
I agree. I was trying to look for maybe a moment, an exchange between the actor and the director where that's really clear. I mean, as the play progresses, basically what you see, right, is he starts out waiting for his audition. He finally gets in the room, right? And that's where the disembodied director voice comes from. And if actors who are listening, you know kind of how that works. In a lot of audition rooms, it's an empty stage or an empty space, and then like back behind the lights, right, in the darkness, maybe even sitting at the back of the house or middle of the house, is the director watching, right? And they sort of bark notes at you from back there. And so he goes into that situation. He starts, you know, doing his thing in his audition, and the director gives him some redirects that are frankly racist and full of blind spots that the director refuses to acknowledge. And the audition goes badly.
So I'm back here on my page 24, your page 26. And the director says, you know, he's offering a redirect, being a director. He says, arguably no more rational estate than the jealousy that follows it. He's picking up a thought. Anyway, what fascinates us is not only the size of the man, Othello, but the size of his emotion, his passion, the early moderns would call it. I think we need to see it. And then the actor kind of blankly stares at him and is like, what am I supposed to do? Like, because the director is clearly asking for like the image of like the scary black man, the scary monster. And that's not cool.
Right. So we get these moments of the actor, like what his lines are in between these director's lines are takes to the audience, right? They're his interior monologue. He doesn't say these directly to the director until later. Right. You know, and on that same page, you already quoted that, the thing about the rolled R's and the standard American dialect, and
just at the sort of at the end of that giant monologue-y section. So your page 28, he's talking about his experience, you know, running into people in the theater or even outside the theater, and he says, others with no connection whatever to the theater would offer an unsolicited, oh, you're an actor? You'll make a great Othello one day. And my response, bang an at the emergency exit from the inside, what? I'll make a great emotionally unstable misogynist murderer? Like, yeah. What the fuck? Literally, what? I just,
yeah.
And that I think is perhaps, I mean, maybe it's not a brilliant example of a microaggression, because maybe it's just like an actual aggression, but it's this idea, right, that sort of well-meaning white person sees, oh, here's a black man in front of me who says they're an actor, who says mm-hmm. that they're a Shakespearean. Let's see, what do I know about the Shakespeare canon? Oh, Othello's a black man. Right. Well, if you're an actor, you'll probably be great at being Othello. And that is the train of thought. But they don't take it further to be like, oh yeah, no, shit. Othello fucks up. Othello murders his wife. And I think that Othello is a victim in the play. I make this case in some places. You know, Othello is not, he's not just looking for any excuse to go right. murder his wife. He genuinely right. loves her and then puts his trust in the wrong person and is misled and to tragic results. And this is why I don't love the play, because it's so fucking avoidable if you would just fucking talk to your fucking wife, man. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Yeah, Othello is not, I think, the like noble role model
right.
that it's not the compliment that kind of person thinks it is, right? Like yeah. why they're being pigeonholed because of the way that their race presents to the world, you know, the way that non-black people read that black body. They go, oh, Othello. They don't go Romeo. They don't go Hamlet. They don't go right. Oberon. They don't go fucking Beatrice. Like, they see you. They see that you are a black man, and they go, Othello.
Yeah.
Maybe they think about Aaron if they have that knowledge of the canon, but most likely they don't. Anyway.
Yeah.
I've been talking. Why don't you say some words
that's
now?
Okay. I was searching for the, like... Yes, this play is about, you know, racism and microaggressions in mm-hmm. white American theater, right? Mm-hmm. It is also, I think, a really deep examination of Othello, right?
Mm.
From yes. an actor's process of, like, he has clearly, you know, done the actor homework, quote unquote, right? Mm-hmm. like, understanding this character, not just from his own lived experience, but by what he finds in the text and, you know, relates to and mines out of the text. And he spends a lot of his audition showing that to the director mm-hmm. who poo-poos most of what he says. But also there was like, he struggles, the actor struggles with like hating Othello mm-hmm. and hating the part and everything that it means for him as a black man, but also loving Othello. And
yeah.
And I was trying to find that moment because it is so...
Right. He talks about protecting Othello.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where is that?
On my page 39, I think I have found it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right here. Yep.
The truest truth is that I am no Danish prince either, or Titania. I am only me. I have only this to lend to anything. And I love him. Not Othello so much, except in that if I act him, he is me, and I love me dearly. I love Shakespeare. I love the sound of his voice. I love to hear him speaking through me. I love him just as I love you, black man, for you speak through me too. And you can see all the scant in your noisy-ass, fearsome fucking voice has done me in America. But there's a part where he calls him his brother who needs protecting,
yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm not.
It's
finding
a little.
It.
It's a little further down.
Okay.
Yeah, he says, and yet to most, I have only ever looked like this one, this black man, and he is lover, warrior, and fool all at once. Tragically flawed, yes, just like you, brother man, and like me, like everybody. He is wholly human, but he is black, and to be black here has only ever meant to be more misread, misrepresented, misinterpreted, more misunderstood. Is that what you're thinking?
No, like he literally, I mean, yes, that is a good yeah. moment, but he also says, there's sort of a climactic moment, and I remember seeing it and hearing it, I just can't find it in the play right now, in the text right now, but he says I look at him as my brother who needs protecting.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I love him like a brother that needs protecting.
Yeah.
And that, like, that tension between avoiding this role. Yeah.
Here it is. Maybe. It's at the bottom of my 32, so that's your 34.
Okay.
He is an arrogant, ill-mannered, perfect, precocious black child in the body of an aging badass. But he is a boy, like Tamir Rice was a boy, like Trayvon Martin was a boy, who would challenge you for the right to his truth and his dreams, because that's what boys do, just as I strain at the bonds of decorum to challenge you now. Maybe? Is that what you're looking for?
No, he explicitly says the words, he's my brother who needs protecting. Oh. And I'm trying to find those words and I can't find them.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Look at me thinking I'm helping.
I mean, you are. You're pulling out some really great, poignant moments. Yeah. And that, like, place this play in a moment in time, which also I love, right?
Yes.
It's very now, but... But yeah, there's, but I love the tension of, like, it's like he's auditioning for the play, right? So like this character, the actor, is auditioning for the play. So he's putting himself out there to play it. But he is not sure that he really wants to go through with playing it, especially not for this director, right? And the longer he has this moment in the audition with that director, he realizes that this is not the show that he wants to be a part of if he were to ever play Othello.
And the director, like, shuts down.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of get into it, and then the director's like, look, this is not the time or the place for this conversation.
Right. Right.
And the actor's just like, well, fuck you.
Yeah. And he's like, when is it also the time? Yeah.
It is. Yeah. He says, I have underlined this and starred this and written cite this in all caps. Because it does show up in my diss. He says, there's nothing more infuriating than white folks acting like they know your story well enough to tell it without your help. That I think is the core. That's that is this play. That's the thesis of this play.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is stop speaking for people who aren't you.
Yeah.
White people. Right. Stop it. Sit down. Listen.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the talk back that I heard him give after I saw this, he talked about how actually he, as an actor, he's like a unicorn of black male actors who has not actually played Othello.
Has he not?
He has never played it. He has, I mean, as of, you know, January 2019, when I went and saw this play, he had never played it. What he said, though, because somebody had asked him, they were like, how many times have you played Othello, or have you played Othello? And he was like, nope, I've never played it. I'd like to direct it.
Yeah.
But I would watch
the hell out of that.
Yeah. As would I. You know, because he clearly has some things he would like to say with this play and with this part. That in a way that only he can say them, right? But I found that interesting that he says he has never once played the part. He is maybe the only guy who has managed to avoid it in his storied career.
Yeah.
And maybe for this reason, you know, like for all of the things he lays out in this show. And that's why he won't do it. Because there are just too many white directors really wanting to do something with this play. And it,
It's a lot. This play is a lot.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it's a one-man show. It's short. It's the whole text of the play is like 40 pages. It's, you know, it's a quick read, but it's not an easy read. If you are going into it with the expectation that you're going to get something out of it, that you're going to learn something from it, it takes work, right? You have to read carefully. You have to stop and think and let it resonate and see the way, as a white person, if you are in fact a white person, see the ways that you are reflected in this text, even as much as you might like to think that you're not, right? Even white people benefit from systemic racism, even if they are not racist. You know, that is the problem with white supremacy and with racism in America, is that even those of us who, you know, oh, I'm not racist and I'm doing the work and I'm an ally and so on and so forth. We still benefit from these structures that are designed to keep white people on top and everybody else out and down and subjected and subjugated and oppressed. And so you have to do that work. You have to sit there with this text and see, okay, this is me. I'm in this text. I am.
Yeah.
And how am I in this text and how can I be better?
Yeah.
Which is not to make the story about me, because it's not. This is not my story. I'm not trying to center myself in it. I want to be clear that to engage with this text responsibly as a white person requires work.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it requires bearing witness responsibly, right? And not... Mm-hmm. And staying present and trying not to second guess and trying really hard not to center yourself, right? Yeah. And trying to really hard not to relate it to your own experiences, because you've never had this experience.
No.
Right? Like, no matter how relatable you think some moments might be, no, it's not, right? So, like, staying present while reading is, I think, one of the hardest bits of the work while you're going through this play, is just staying in it with him, if that makes sense. It's tough.
Yeah. So I guess this is just like our pitch to get your hands on the text and read it. Do that work for yourself and your community, especially if you're Shakespearean, especially if you are in the theater industry in any way. You need this text and you need it now and you need it always. And you need to read it and you need to think about it and you need to do the work.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. It's so good.
It's so good, you guys.
I always feel weird about saying like a tough work is good, because I'm like, oh, it's so good. But
it is.
Good in a hard way, you know? Yeah. Like in the way that you can enjoy something that is difficult.
Which you can, otherwise, no one would get PhDs.
Yeah. Right, yeah. I mean, like, yeah, I wouldn't call this... lighthearted entertainment. Like, that's not what this is. I'm not even sure I'd call this a night of entertainment. Like, if you went to see the show, you know, this is because you're going to, to do some soul work on yourself. Yeah. It's closer almost to going to church than it is to like or going to a night at the theater. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. This is. But it's so worth it.
It is.
It's so worth it.
It is.
It's so good.
Yeah.
It's inspiring. It's invigorating, right? Yeah. If you let yourself be affected by this text, you're going to come out ready to make some changes, I think. Yeah. Or I think you can come out ready to make some changes. Yeah. I won't guarantee anything. Yeah.
Or
not
just
my
also
position.
Like ready to listen in a new way, you know? That's kind of how I felt. I just ready to take a back seat and listen some more.
So anyway,
such a good word.
Get out there. Read this text.
Yes.
Consume all of the media that you can.
And to be clear, like it does stand on its own. Like you don't need to be an expert on Othello or really to even have read or seen Othello. He gives you just as much Othello as you need, right? You get a lot of the text because he's an actor auditioning to play Othello. So he's got like some Othello in there, right? There's text in there. So like it stands on its own. But I do feel like we were saying this off the air and I just wanted to repeat it because I think the reason why we landed on calling this episode a 202, right? Contextualizing it within... Othello, right, is that these plays are adjacent to one another. One speaks to the other, but you don't necessarily need both of them to understand both of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? It'll enhance your understanding, I think. It'll do nothing but help you if you're familiar with both. But you don't need necessarily a familiarity with Othello to enjoy this, to enjoy working through this. So, that's that.
Well...
Let's gossip a little bit.
Let's gossip. Let's do it. We don't.
I feel breathless every time after I talk about this, this play in particular. Just even discussing it is invigorating. Yeah. So like
I'm a little fired up.
Yeah.
I mean, on a slightly different note, the first thing that we want to tell you about this week is this NPR story from 2009 that made the rounds of my Twitter feed this last week. It's amazing. I sent this to you. This is the thing that I was like,
oh yes.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there's a play, I guess, that is Romeo and Juliet, but not. Yeah. It's so good. It's so good. It's Romeo. The title of the article, the NPR article, is Romeo and Juliet, Just as You Misremembered It.
Yeah.
And it's this off-Broadway show that comes from people like being sat down and being like, all right, tell me the story of Romeo and Juliet. And it's like, well, I haven't read it since high school or college, or I've never read it or whatever. And so it's just kind of like cobbled together. And it's this glorious, glorious mismatch. And like they have some excerpts from like the balcony scene. And one of them is Romeo, oh Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo, something or something, and you are the sun. I don't remember. I don't have it memorized. And like that is the line from this performance, is like the actor saying, I don't have it memorized.
Yeah. It's so good.
Yeah. It's delightful. So there's like a whole write up, and then there's like an All Things Considered Morning Edition audio. It's 4 minutes. It's, I just like, do yourself a favor and give it a listen.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And also like the guy who wrote / directed it ? Has like never read it. Like doesn't.
Yeah.
And that's, it's just, it's brilliant. It's brilliant and it's fun. And
although how he escaped his American education without having read Romeo and Juliet, did he just not do his homework? I don't think it's entirely possible.
Yeah, he's the co-director of the Nature Theater of Oklahoma. Right. So maybe he's just from Oklahoma. Could buzz, which is also a misquotation of Shakespeare. Anyway, read the thing. It's fantastic. Yeah. It will bring a smile to your face.
Yes.
Next up on our list is March the 26th. If you are around the internet, you know, the internet, if you exist in an internet space, my program, the Hudson Strode program here at the University of Alabama, is hosting a Zoom webinar thing, a talk, you know, those, they're going around. It's a conversation between Joyce Green McDonald and Reggie Wilburn, who are both big deal scholars. And the conversation is why pre-modern critical race studies now, and it's gonna be amazing. So I'm just saying, if that sounds like something that you are into, mark your calendars. It is happening at 3 p.m. Central. Let me check my calendar because I'm not entirely sure.
Is there an event link to this yet? Because I remember we talked about this in our gossip segment last episode as well.
Oh, did
we? Didn't have a
did
link
we?
For it. Yeah, we did.
Shit, did we?
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, I'm telling you again. No, there is not yet. There's not yet a link. But there is now more, slightly more. I'm working on a poster. it's going to be on Zoom. It's 3 p.m. Central Standard Time on Friday, the 26th of March. We are not yet sure if it will be available as a recording after the fact. Mm. So if you are interested, plan for it to be live. We're looking at it. Is I should say it is possible for us to do an upload after the fact, but we have to get everybody's permission that they're okay having this recorded, and we haven't gotten that yet, and it may not come, especially because I think both of them are going to be talking about some works in progress. So anyway, keep your eye out. And if you are jonesing for the link, you can follow me on Twitter at Jess Hamlet. I will tweet it when it is available. You can follow the Hudson Strode program at Hud Strode. That's HUDSTRODE on Twitter. It will be me. I will be tweeting from the account when we have the link. I will throw that up. those are the, you should just use, uh-huh. and then, you know, maybe by our next episode, there will be a link. In fact, yeah. I think probably there will be a link by our next episode, but just mark your calendars, especially because like our next episode is going to come out just a couple of weeks
beginning
before that.
Of March.
So,
yeah.
So, mark your calendar now. Anyway.
Yeah.
What else, Aubrey?
Yeah. So, the most recent edition of the Borrowers and Lenders Journal.
Yeah, it's a journal of Shakespeare and adaptation.
There we go. There were two, not one, but two reviews of this here little podcast in the latest edition. So we're going to put the link up to that and you can read the lovely things that the reviewers had to say about us. They were operating on some dated information, which maybe I should reach out to them personally and be like, hey, fix that. But other than that, like they both went through, both reviewers went through this, our 101, 201 sequences of two different plays, which I found interesting. But like, thanks to them. And, you know, because it's nice to have good press and a good little boost for us. And it's flattering, to say the least. So if you want to read those nice things and what other people think of us in like a scholarly way, then go read that. That's all I have to say about that. I guess.
Yeah.
It was nice.
It's nice. It's cool. Yeah. I mean, it does say that you should follow us on social media and that we're active on both Instagram and Twitter. We're not active on Instagram, to be clear.
We're not super active on Twitter anymore.
We are more active consistently on Twitter.
Yes.
Yes. We would like to be. Perhaps we will be again someday. Maybe even someday soon, maybe with season 5. But as we have said, we are both sort of in transitional periods in our lives
with like full-time things to do. Yeah, so like every 6 months you'll get a little gem on Instagram. It's all right. Well, anyway.
So I think we're done.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you leave the podcast more informed than when you started.
Yeah, tune in next time for our final episode of the season. This is it. We did it. We came back and we did it. We did a nice little season. Now it's done. We're doing Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay is what we're doing popular demand. And by popular demand, I mean two people. Two people said.
Two people voted.
Want to do a history play. So there it is. I don't love Friar Bacon, but...
But I'm here for Friar Bungay. So, like, if you don't like bacon, you can at least be here for Bungay is all I'm saying.
The play is weird. It's a weird... whatever. No spoilers. Yeah. We'll talk about it next week. Okay. Wham-let out.
The Hurly Burly Shakespeare Show is produced and edited by Aubrey Whitlock and Jess Hamlet. If you enjoyed our podcast, please tell your friends, rate us, leave a review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcasts.
For show notes and other stuff, you can visit our website at www.hurlyburlyshakespeareshow.com.
You can get in touch with us by emailing holla@hurlyburlyshakespeareshow.com.
You can also find us at Hurly Burly Shakes on Instagram.
Or at Hurly Burly Shake, no S, on Twitter.
I acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land from which I record, the Muskegee Creek Nation, and pay my respect to their elders past and present.
I acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land currently referred to as Stanton, Virginia, the Monacan and Manahoic Nations, and pay my respect to their elders past and present.
All opinions you heard are strictly our own and not affiliated with the institutions we represent.
Yeah. Yeah, we should maybe, do some cross training at some point.
Yeah, we should maybe.
Someday.
Someday I will also maybe have a skill that you will need to use, and then it will be a fair exchange.
Yeah.
Whatever, I taught you to make bagels.
You did. You have so many skills that I need to learn.
Me too. Yeah. My skills are in the kitchen. It's like, don't say bedroom. What is the room I want? My skills
we were both thinking it. So. Bathroom.
But I couldn't think of the word kitchen.